part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the challenges facing military families. Journalist Kristen Henderson is our guest. Her new book, While They're at War, profiles women and men on the home front in North Carolina whose spouses have been deployed for combat. The book offers readers in-depth portraits of two very different women, Marissa Boots and Beth Pratt. They are married to junior enlisted men in the Army's 82nd Airborne Division stationed at Fort Bragg. Henderson says the two women didn't have much in common. One opposed the war in Iraq. The other said opposition to the war made life harder for soldiers and their families. But this they had in common. Their husbands were deployed to Iraq in 2003. And Henderson says, quoting here, they both faced the frightening challenge of their husbands' first deployments, and they knew it wasn't likely to be their last either, given America's increasing military commitments around the world. Even if their husbands came home, they wouldn't be home to stay. Kristen Henderson, a Quaker, is also a military spouse. Her husband is a Navy chaplain. And in addition to While They're at War, the true story of American families on the home front, Kristen Henderson is the author of Driving by Moonlight, A Journey Through Love, War, and Infertility. Her writing has also appeared in the Washington Post. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for Kristen Henderson. You can join the discussion with questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. While They're at War, the true story of American families on the home front is published by Houghton Mifflin. Kristen Henderson, nice to talk with you again. Welcome.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be back.
Yeah. A reporter once asked you, does it ever bother your husband that you're writing about the wives instead of the real story? And you say early in the book, While They're at War, that question speaks volumes. What does it say, and how did you respond to their question?
Well, it says that we're very aware of the sacrifices that go on in the battlefield. We think it's a lot of TV time. But we're much less aware of the fact that when you send a soldier to war, you send a whole family to war, and there are sacrifices that go on the home front every single day. And, you know, I responded to that question, I hope with good grace, because he meant well. He was fumbling for the right words. But he just didn't know, and he's not alone. I mean, less than 1% of the population serves in the military anymore, so most people have no idea what that's like to send the one you love to war and the kinds of sacrifices that are required to make that happen.
Yeah. You also note that the home front doesn't get much screen time. You say there's the tearful goodbye, the joyful homecoming, and in between the occasional yellow ribbon moment. There are also stories about the knock at the door, and we'll talk about that later, I'm sure. Why don't we get more stories that go beyond the cliche, the stories that have the props, and you could almost...
And hear the strings swelling,
yeah,
in the background.
Right.
there are several reasons. One is the fact that we military spouses during a deployment, we keep a pretty stiff upper lip, a lot of us. And that's because, in my case anyway, you know, I was holding it together pretty well, as long as I didn't talk about it. You know, I may have cried that morning in the shower, but then I pulled myself together. And if I were to talk about it again in the middle of the day, I'd wind up crying and ruin the rest of my day. So I was actually staying with my sister during parts of my husband's deployment to Iraq, and, you know, she had a front row seat on what was going on, if anybody did. But when she would ask me how I was doing, I'd say, oh, I'm fine, because, you know, I didn't really want to talk about it. And when she read the book, she said, Kristen, I had no idea. Yeah. So we hide it pretty well. Some of it's pride, too. We don't want to admit how hard it is. And to a certain extent, I think until recently there's been a lack of interest. When I was researching this book, I went back to look at previous writings about the home front to see what I could learn about how the experience may have changed. And it was really hard to find anything. You know, there were letter collections, but mostly it was letters from the battlefield to the home front, because letters from the home front the soldiers had to carry around, and if they were on the move, they couldn't do it. So most of those letters were lost. So we haven't heard a lot of, you know, from the women. And in the past, it was almost all women. And of course, we all know that until recent decades, women's voices and, quote-unquote, women's work wasn't valued as much. So there just wasn't as much interest.
Mm. Was it tough for people to open up to you? Was it tough for you to get them to open up?
I expected it to be. But actually, when we're among ourselves, there's a lot of comfort in being with people who know exactly what you're going through without saying anything. And they knew that I had been through the same thing, that I was one of them. So they trusted me. So they really did open up in a way that I really appreciated. And when I would thank them, particularly when some of them were talking about times in their lives that were incredibly intimate and painful at the same time, they would say that, you know, they really just hoped it would help someone going through the same thing and maybe avoid some of the mistakes they'd made. And I think, too, they appreciated having a voice. Again, for so long, the sacrifices that they've been making have been overlooked and not recognized. And, you know, it's just nice to be appreciated now.
Yeah. What's that bond like between people who have someone in the military?
I think the key moment for me that really drove home that there was a bond there was I was talking to another wife right after our husbands came home from Iraq. And she looked at me and she said, I don't think civilians can fully appreciate how terrible the relief is when you finally have them in your arms. It was all she said, and we both suddenly, our eyes were real shiny, you know, about to cry, because it brought back all those feelings. And it is a terrible relief. That's exactly sums it up.
Mm. And that's the final chapter of the book. Trying to get back to normal, huh?
Yes. And you know, when they return, the story's not over. You know, it looks like the happy ending when you've got them back, and that is the main thing. But both of you are different after a deployment. Again, I think we're all aware that soldiers are changed from their experiences in war, but what gets forgotten is that the spouses are different, too, especially women often have grown quite a bit in terms of their independence. They may sometimes have a hard time opening the family up again to make a space for that returning service member. Or the service member sometimes feels threatened by, you know, a spouse who doesn't seem to need them. So, you know, if the returning service member can say, you know, my wife is stronger, she's a stronger woman, we're a better team for it and better able to handle this lifestyle, then the marriage is strengthened. But, you know, if not, then marriages can be undermined. It's a very stressful time.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the whole thing has got to be very stressful because, for example, in the winter of 2003, you note that the 82nd had been just back from Afghanistan when it got word that in a couple of months it would be redeployed.
Yes, these tight back-to-back deployments are really tough. I mean, in the previous decades, if your soldier deployed, you know, twice in his whole career in 20 years, that was pretty normal. And now in the last 3 or 4 years, we're looking at families that are on their third or fourth major deployment. Now, the Navy, Marines, and Air Force have long done regular deployments. That's part of their mission. But they come and go generally for shorter periods, and, you know, and they're maybe set up a little better to deal with it. But for the Army, for Army families, this was quite a change, and, you know, they're stepping up to the plate, but they're getting tired. After a certain point when you're gone more than you're home, especially if you have children, they're growing up without you. So it's tough.
Is the military addressing that?
They're trying. I mean, you know, the military has to do what they're called to do by our civilian leaders, but they're stretched pretty thin. The thing that really struck me as I was working on this book was how many services are in place for families. I learned that during Vietnam that was not the case. One Army wife was telling me that at the time, if you lived on base with your soldier, when he deployed to Vietnam, you had to move off base because housing on base was for soldiers, not for families. So at the moment when you most needed a community around you that understood and contact and information, you know, something to lessen the uncertainty and the fear, you were pushed out into the community where nobody understood. So after the war, those Vietnam-era wives pressured the military to develop official formal support groups for families, and they have responded, and all the services have those now, and they do make a big difference.
Yeah. So is there kind of basic training, a military 101 for military spouses?
There is. But, you know, families don't enlist or accept commissions. They're not in the military. You can't order them to attend. And I'm a case in point. When my husband first joined, I was the most civilian of civilians. I had knew nothing about the military. I was kind of suspicious of it, frankly, but you know, my husband wanted to do this, I felt, you know, and I wanted to support him as my life partner, so I knew this was something he'd always wanted to do. But I figured it was his job. It didn't really affect me. So I could keep on going about my life and not mess with any of that. And as he began to deploy, especially after September 11th, I began to realize that the military controls their service members' lives in a way that, and to a degree, that no other institution in America does. And by extension, it also controls my life, just in terms of the sacrifices that are demanded. The sacrifices, there are a long list of stresses and pressures that are placed on families. I think some folks assume that, you know, if you have kids, maybe it's like temporary single parenthood. And there is that. I mean, your responsibilities at home increase dramatically. But there's much more, and it's a little bit more intangible. Some of the hardest things to deal with are the loneliness and the fear. And I was talking with some chaplains on Fort Bragg, and they were telling me that early in the Iraq War, they noted that a lot of the spouses were experiencing the same symptoms as people who have a loved one with a terminal illness. And as they listed those symptoms, I just had this flash of recognition because I'd had those same symptoms while my husband was in Iraq. You know, the shortness of breath, the insomnia, crying jags, and imagining my husband's funeral. And the thing was, I didn't know it was so common. I didn't know there were ways to deal with it. And, you know, knowledge is power. If I had, you know, attended any of these military 101 classes, I would have had a better sense of what the emotional cycle of deployment is and would have been better prepared to deal with it.
Yeah. I mentioned in my introduction that you are a Quaker. Are there many of you? Are there many of you as military spouses out there?
I think I've met one soldier who was raised Quaker. No, there's not too many, but, you know, there aren't too many Quakers generally. Mm. But the thing I value about Quakerism is its emphasis on process. You know, the goal is important, but how you get there is just as important, even if you never fully arrive at the destination. So, you know, while a commitment to peace may mean that your goal is to finally eliminate war from this world, which is actually something that I find hard to believe could actually happen, you know, realistically, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do everything in our power in our daily lives to eliminate as many of the causes of war as possible or to minimize its effects. So, you know, that's what I try to focus on is, you know, war really affects military families and demands a lot of them. And they don't have much control over whether or not we go to war. That's a decision made by our civilian leaders. And the children especially. I mean, they're so helpless in so many ways and really need not only the support of their families, but of you know, civilians they come in contact with, like their teachers and scout leaders. They can all make a difference in how they cope with this.
Mm. You know, one of the things as civilians, I think, thanks to the stories that we get about the home front, we see military families portrayed as monolithic. But you point out that while virtually none of those who serve are from America's elite classes, military families are a diverse group of people.
Yeah, actually, I feel very patriotic when I look around at our military because it really does represent in many ways the best of the American melting pot. I mean, like you said, other than the fact that the elite educated and particularly liberal educated class is severely underrepresented, in other ways it is very egalitarian. People from every race, religious group, background, educational level are in the military, and they all have an equal opportunity to advance. And in that sense, yeah, we should be proud of our military.
It's interesting that you mention patriotism, feeling patriotic. That's one reason why people join the military, but you report in the book it's not the biggest reason people join. Why do people enlist?
The number one reason is for economic opportunity. They tend to, particularly among the enlisted ranks, they tend to come from the upwardly mobile working class, so from areas where there aren't a lot of other job opportunities, or where racism has played a part. And, you know, the military offers opportunities that they can't find in the civilian world.
But that changes with deployment, doesn't it?
it offers more opportunities that you don't get in the civilian world, just in a different way.
But I'm thinking about a couple's financial situation.
That's true. I think it is a misconception that military families do well financially during deployment. And some do manage to put some money away because of the increased combat pay. But there are a lot of hidden costs. For instance, among National Guard members who are married, more than half report that their income drops when they switch from their civilian job to their military pay. And in addition, both National Guard spouses and active duty spouses often have to either quit a job if they're working or cut back on their hours to handle all the increased responsibilities at home. Plus, they may have more child care costs now that they only have one caregiver. And that's if they can even find child care, because particularly with active duty families, they're often in a new town with no network of support, and they may not know where to turn, particularly if, like me, they haven't taken or hadn't taken those military 101 classes, which can tell you that the military actually does help you find or provide you with child care in many cases.
Mm. The husbands of Marissa Boots and Beth Pratt, Charlie and Luigi, what led them to enlist?
In both cases, it was economic opportunity. Luigi's family were immigrants from South America, and he saw it as a chance to, earn some money for college and help his family out. And Charlie and Marissa Boots were from Erie, Pennsylvania, which is, in the Rust Belt. So there weren't a lot of good jobs in the offing where they were.
Mm. What would you like to say at this point, by way of introduction, to the two women who are central to your book, Marissa and Beth?
Right. I talked to dozens of families, actually all over the country and around the world as well, because our service members and their families are everywhere. And all their stories are in the book. But I focused in particular on Marissa and Beth because I thought they really best represented just the diversity of military families. I mean, people always ask me, so what do military families think of the war? Well, if you ask 10 different families, you're going to get 10 different answers. And Marissa and Beth represent that. Marissa was very young when her husband deployed, about 24, and she'd had a pretty tough childhood growing up in Erie, and she had a 6-year-old daughter. And just before her husband left, she'd landed her dream job as a paralegal. But it was pretty demanding. She was working 60 hours a week, driving all over the state of North Carolina, high-stress job. And then her husband left, and she's dealing with all the child care, all the bills, everything at home. Plus, she's volunteering with the family readiness group at her husband's unit and helping other spouses get through it. And part of this was her way of coping with the stress. She overworked.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped keep the fear that she was feeling, that anticipatory grief, at bay, even as she fielded phone calls from Charlie at 2 a.m. in the morning from the front lines where, he was missing his family and, needed some uplift. So she was trying to keep his spirits up while she was trying to keep her daughters and her own up, too. And she supported the war, as you mentioned. She felt like protests in the streets really just undermined morale from her standpoint. Now, Beth, on the other hand, was completely different. She was in her early 30s. She had just gotten married for the second time, had no children, and she had multiple postgraduate degrees and was brand new to Fayetteville, so she didn't know anybody. And she also opposed the war, so she felt politically isolated at the time. And for her, it was a really lonely time, and she began to withdraw from the military community, and you know, she didn't know anyone in the civilian community. And eventually she slipped into a clinical depression and was on the verge of suicide. And you know, even though she had withdrawn from the military community, at the same time she still had civilian neighbors, she worked with civilians. If they, and her family, you know, which was far away, they sensed something was wrong. If they had known, you know, how to help her, how to reach out, what kind of resources were available to her, they could have pointed her in the right direction and made a huge difference in her life, but they didn't know. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do with this book is educate both spouses and civilians who may come in contact with them where the help and support lie and how they can you know, access it.
Yeah. What kind of reaction has the book received to date from military spouses, from the people who are actually in the service, and from readers like myself who are civilians?
From the military side, I've heard is thank you, you know, just appreciation for giving them a voice and, you know, honoring their sacrifices. And from their, you know, the service members who deploy, I mean, they're fascinated to find out what's going on exactly while they're gone. Among civilians, it's the same thing. I mean, I hear they say things like it's eye-opening, you know, that, like my sister who said she had no idea. You know, and it also is empowering because now when they meet somebody, they know what to say. They know how to reach out.
Hmm. How has Beth reacted to the book?
Beth took a big, I felt like took a big risk because she was exposing a really painful part of her life, a real low point. And so she really kind of went out on the limb. But again, she felt like if she could help someone else from getting to the edge like that the way she did, then it was worth it. But she was a little uneasy, but she's a very brave woman.
Yeah. I would imagine that a lot of military spouses reading this book, who haven't been military spouses, let's say, for very long, might think to themselves after reading this, I thought I was the only one.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I certainly felt that way. And there's real comfort in finding out that you're not the only one. The other thing is that, you know, this is the hardest thing. A wartime deployment is probably the hardest thing that a military spouse will go through. And, you know, if you can make it through this, you really will be a stronger person for it. And there are many other aspects of, you know, of the military life that are very rewarding. I mean, if there weren't, then none of us would put up with all this. And for some, like Beth, it's not. And she and her husband, he's actually now out of the Army, and that was the right choice for them. But for others, it is a very rewarding life because you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. Even soldiers who don't agree with the war, who I've spoken with, for them, they feel like they're playing their part in, you know, in our American democracy, which is that the military follows the orders of democratically elected civilians. It's sort of, I think, like being involved in, say, our legal system. Someone has to be the prosecutor, someone has to be the defending attorney, and they all play their roles in order so that the system works properly.
Hmm. I mentioned in my introduction that Marissa expressed the opinion that opposition to the war made life harder for soldiers and their families. Would you comment on that? What do you think that's right?
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to be perceived differently by different people. But for example, I was talking with a veterans advocate the other day, and this is not to say that people shouldn't express freely what their opinions are about the war, because and that's part of a democracy. And even the folks who didn't approve of the protest said, well, that's their right. That's what my husband's over there for, which I thought was very interesting. But this particular veterans advocate was saying that it does exact a real toll on the returning veterans if, after they've made these enormous sacrifices and they're struggling, the key is to find meaning in your sacrifice. I mean, that's a big part of finding healing after you've, you know, been traumatized or hurt while on deployment. And if you can't find meaning, if you come back to a country where the majority of the people say, well, your sacrifice wasn't worth it because this war was wrong, that does put quite a burden on people who are struggling to deal with what they've been through.
Hmm. How does the ability or inability of loved ones left at home to soldier on affect those who are under fire?
Well, soldiers are human beings. They're not machines. So I mean, that family readiness is it's part of a three-legged stool, really, of military readiness. In order to have a military that can deploy and be effective in the field, they have to have good training, good equipment, and they have to have families who are ready to deal with the separation and the stress. Because if the soldier's out in the field and he knows his family's back home struggling, that's distracting. And where they are, distractions can be fatal. And that's why the military has put so much money into these programs for families to help them get through a deployment, because it does actually pay off in you know, a more effective military. The area where I see a real gap is in communicating the fact that these services exist. I mean, the fact that I didn't know about most of them until I started researching this book tells you something. I mean, only about a third of military families live on base. And the military does a pretty good job of reaching those families and getting the word out. But once they're off base, it seems to be hard to get the word to the people who need to know it. And sometimes the families like me, they don't really want to be reached. I mean, it's a two-way street. The families also have to reach out to get that information.
Hmm. Journalist Kristen Henderson is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book is While They're at War, The True Story of American Families on the Home Front. Henderson is a Quaker. She's also a military spouse. Her husband is a Navy chaplain. In addition to While They're at War, she is the author of Driving by Moonlight, A Journey Through Love, War, and Infertility. And her writing has also appeared in the Washington Post. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join the conversation with a question or a comment. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. What's the situation for husbands who are the ones on the home front?
About 7% of spouses are men, so they're a minority. But they go through exactly the same emotional cycles that the women do. It's just that they respond like guys. So where women, I was talking with a Navy widow the other day, and she's done some research on this, and she said that women wallow, men replace. And what that tells you is that women need to process, often with other women, and men get busy and find more comfort in doing. So there was one National Guard spouse named Ken, and he said that while his wife was deployed to Iraq, he was the only man in his unit's family readiness group, and he got a lot out of going to the meetings and being with other people who were going through the same thing, enjoyed getting a hug now and then, you know, in a time of his life when he wasn't getting many hugs, and it was like hugging a sister. But and he told the other women that if there was anything leaking or breaking, he was glad to help fix it. But he didn't necessarily want to know how everybody felt about the leaking and the breaking. So, and he actually stayed busy by founding a charity to support the troops called Operation A Bit of Home while his wife was gone, which collected, you know, hygiene and luxury items to send off to troops who go to, there's apparently a resort, like an R&R resort, quote unquote, in Iraq that soldiers can go to for a few days just to get a break. And so he provides items to stock that location.
One of the things that you write about in the book is what you call the capital D and capital W detachment and withdrawal phase. Would you talk about the emotions that accompany the time before a loved one is deployed?
Yeah, that was another one of those things when I learned it. It was like, oh, aha, I get it. My husband and I, before he deployed each time, would wind up fighting at some point. And eventually we learned what it was. I mean, he knew through his training as a chaplain. And that is that it, when you fight before a separation, it makes it easier to say goodbye. And subconsciously, somehow we know this. And so it's very common for couples to bicker and detach from each other ahead of time. And once you recognize it, you can often pull yourself out of it and laugh at it as you realize what you're doing. But once, if you fight right up to the end, once the separation happens, then you often feel guilty immediately afterward. And the first 6 weeks of a deployment are, that's the time where it's often the toughest because you're trying to figure this thing out and juggle all these new responsibilities and new worries and fears and concerns. And It's often a time of emotional chaos, but after about 6 weeks, most people kind of get their sea legs and get it figured out, and that can actually be very empowering. You know, like anything else, once you master something, you're like, oh, I can do this, and go on from there.
Marissa's response was, once the deployment happened, you know, keep busy.
Oh yeah.
How did you cope?
Very similarly to Marissa, actually. I stayed very busy. I got more sleep than she did. She only gave herself 4 hours a night. But, yeah, I stayed busy. Some spouses turn off the news, for instance. Marissa and Beth both did that. They found any news, any mention from Iraq to be very distressing. And, it, you know, any information they needed, they figured, you know, Marissa figured she was getting from her family readiness group, and that was all she needed to know. To a certain extent, I was the same way. I mean, the only thing that mattered was whether or not I got a knock at the door. But for me, you know, knowledge is power, and I'm kind of a news junkie. But if you watch the news too much, it gets kind of addictive. And, you know, like any addiction, it can leave you just sort of wasted on the couch feeling helpless, which is not a good thing during a deployment because there's so little you control already. And you really can't control the news, and often it's bad. So I would let myself watch a little bit of news in the morning and then a little bit before bed at night, but, you know, I would ration it and then turn it off. And I certainly did not watch the overnight embed live footage that was coming in at the time.
Yeah. A little bit earlier you talked about soldiers, and when they come home, they need to find meaning in the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
What about that for military spouses?
It's the same thing. You know, and if one of them is struggling, the whole family is struggling. I mean, families are units, and it's the same with the children.
Yeah, let's talk about the children. Marissa and Charlie had a daughter when he signed up. I think you mentioned she was six.
Mm-hmm.
What would you like to tell us about the emotional ups and downs children experience, a child like Lexi?
Well, children, again, just like the home front parents of both genders, children go through the same emotions. They just aren't as good at coping with it. I mean, Lexi, for instance, she was only six, so she couldn't really articulate what she was feeling, the fear and the grief. But, I mean, at age six, she'd been potty trained for years. And after her father left, for the first few weeks, she was wetting herself during the day. You know, so it was just coming out in other ways. And children, often you'll see, I mean, they react in different ways. Some children will become the super student, you know, coping that way, getting extra busy. Some will withdraw or act out. Again, that first 6 weeks is that critical coping period. And if you see a child struggling after that 6 weeks, that usually means that they have a home front parent at home who is struggling too and isn't quite able to meet their needs.
Mm. Back at the outset of the first Gulf War, I knew a couple with children, and both husband and wife, mother and father, were in the Guard, and it seemed that there was a possibility that both could have been called up.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out neither was. Is this a possibility today?
Oh, it sure is. In fact, I got an email from a man who he and his wife wound up moving in with their three nieces when both their parents were deployed. And he spent, I think he said it was a year, you know, living in his niece's home and taking care of them. They said the whole neighborhood actually pitched in. So there's a case where the burden was shared, and that's how it should be. You know, when we go to war, the whole nation needs to be putting their shoulder to this if this is what we decide to do as a nation.
Yeah. Well, the woman who I worked with her here at WYLL, she told me this very moving story about how she and her husband were writing letters to their girls and putting them in a shoebox, and if the moment came when they were called and they had to deploy, they would give these letters to the grandparents who were going to care for the daughters. And I was flabbergasted.
There were goodbye letters?
There were a range of letters, I think. You know, like happy birthday.
Oh, okay.
Today, you know, how are you doing at school? You know, those kinds of things, because they're quite young children. What are some of the ways couples try to prepare and provide for a child or children prior to deployment, and is there any support here from the military?
Oh yes, there are. There are a number of programs and even you know technical equipment, for instance. On Fort Bragg, they have a video conferencing room that families can sign up to use so that during a deployment, the children can go in and sit down and talk, you know, via TV screen with their deployed parent. A lot of families do this at home with webcams. A spouse was telling me how her husband read a whole series of children's books, because he would always read the kids their nighttime bed story. And so he read a whole series of them into an audio tape, and then they would play them back while he was gone. Her husband was actually killed in Iraq, and her children still listen to those bedtime stories.
What should we know about the knock at the door?
Well, I really didn't want to write about it in this book, frankly. If it had been up to me originally, you wouldn't know anything about it, because I just didn't want to go there. I mean, it's our worst fear. The odds of it happening are pretty small, but that doesn't change the fact that it's our worst fear. And when I learned about anticipatory grief and that, you know, the vast majority of spouses experience that, I thought, okay, I've got to write about what it is we're all afraid of. So I eventually wound up contacting three different widows, women who'd lost their husbands and were in various stages of recovery. One had lost her husband in Mogadishu back in 1993, I think it was, in that Black Hawk Down incident. So she was well along the way, but, you know, she was still crying when she talked about it. I mean, that's a hole in your life that never goes away. All military death notifications are made in person for the primary and secondary next of kin who are listed on the service member's form before he or she leaves. So if the service member's married, that's usually the wife or husband, and they will, two or three uniformed personnel will come to your door and tell you that news in person, and then they will not leave you until someone comes to be with you. They won't leave you alone. And this system was developed during Vietnam. You may be familiar with the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and that was actually the first major battle of the Vietnam War, what that book describes, when we lost hundreds of soldiers in a single battle. And it overwhelmed the Army's notification system at the time. And during World War II, they'd always sent out telegrams. And that worked in a society where everybody was getting these telegrams. I think it was thousands a week went out telling people that someone they loved was either killed, missing in action, or wounded. So if you got a telegram, probably your neighbor had one or someone around the corner, so you weren't isolated. You know, you had a support system around you. Well, by Vietnam, that wasn't the case anymore. These families were pretty isolated. And during that first week after that battle, the Army was using taxi drivers to deliver this kind of news. And so one of the senior wives in the unit contacted the Pentagon and pressured them to make a change, that you've got to deliver this news in a different way.
Yeah. For someone like Beth, if her husband had been killed, she was an isolated mm-hmm. Army wife.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what would have happened to Beth. They're a couple that are so intertwined and dependent on each other. You know, I mean, every couple has a different dynamic, and he really was her other half. Luigi. She relied on him when she needed cheering up. He knew just how to do it. I mean, they're really well matched in that way.
Yeah, I was really moved by when it was time for him to depart. She was a mess, but she gave him a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us that story.
He was a surfer, and she gave him a surfing magazine, and on, every few pages, she'd written a little message to him. You know, I love you, I miss you, snoring, yeah, I miss it. You know, just, and she left him at the headquarters where the buses were picking him up and taking him to the airfield where he would depart for Iraq. And one of the other wives called her a few hours later and said, Beth, where are you? And, of course, she was crying in her bedroom. And this other woman, Camilla, said, Beth, got to go with me. You've got to see him one more time. We can go to the airfield. She said, oh, I thought we weren't allowed to go there. And she's like, ah, screw him. So this other wife took her down there, and, she found Luigi, and he was so excited to see her, and he'd already read the whole magazine. He came running up with the magazine. He was so thrilled that she had come back to say goodbye one more time.
Yeah. In Beth and Luigi's case, before he was deployed. They were trying to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
Beth was not pregnant when he was deployed, so they opted to try artificial insemination. And you report that more and more military men are banking sperm.
Yeah, they are. And this is something you may not think about, but, if in the course of serving your country, you could be made infertile. It may not kill you. You may recover, but you might be exposed to toxins that could affect your fertility. You could be injured in explosion in a way that affects your fertility. And so, more and more soldiers, it's not a huge number, and it's certainly not part of the standard pre-deployment briefing, but, Gulf War veterans were talking to younger soldiers during the run-up to the Iraq War, and more of these soldiers were paying the few hundred bucks it cost to bank sperm so that in the future, if they wanted kids and were rendered infertile, they would have something to fall back on.
Yeah. Shouldn't this information be part of official briefings prior to deployment?
There is so much to cover in these briefings. And I'll tell you, there are a lot of briefings, and they go on for hours. And there's only so much you can absorb. So to some extent, they have to pick and choose. But this is where the support groups come in. And also, some installations are simply more creative than others. For instance, the Marine Corps Community Services Center at Camp Lejeune is held up as a model of the kinds of workshops and programs that are great for children, because children often get overlooked. But they do a program that's geared directly at children. These puppets, they divide them up by age, so it's all age appropriate and very interactive, so not just sitting there listening. And at the same time, they have a parallel workshop for the parents, teaching them what the children are learning and how they can take that information home. But that's not consistent throughout the military. That's one particular program. It's just at that one base, and it's very effective. But others, we would do well if we could propagate that elsewhere.
Mm. What's the support like for the terrible relief?
You mean when they come back?
Yeah.
There are a lot of services for mental health issues and domestic abuse issues, but there's stigma attached with getting that help. So there's a lot of reluctance on the part of spouses, say, who have seen their relationship slip into violence, to getting help, because they're afraid that if they report that their husband is hitting them, he'll be kicked out of the Army, and they will then lose their income and benefits. And if she's dependent on that, obviously, she doesn't want to see that happen. I was asking the head of social work on Fort Bragg about that, and he said that the folks who come to them for help in domestic violence situations, 95% actually remain in the Army and continue with a relationship that is much improved. And the reason for that, and the reason the Army is so focused on a treatment option rather than a punishment option, is because it's a different population than you find out in the civilian community. In the civilian world, by the time a couple gets help, usually the abuse pattern is long ingrained for years, and it's really hard, if not impossible, to fix that. Whereas in the military community, you're usually talking about very young couples who've been under a lot of stress, who are immature and impulsive and don't know how to handle the stress they've been placed under. And so in treatment, they're able to learn new coping skills and new ways of relating to each other. And it hasn't been going on that long, so the patterns aren't so deeply entrenched. So the good news is that the help is out there, and that that couples should be encouraged to get help when this erupts, because, for 95%, only good comes out of it.
Mm. When you began this project, you'd been a military wife for some period of time. But after this project, or along the way, was there anything that you found to be really revelatory that you had no concept of prior to sitting down to work on while they're at war?
In the larger sense, I think I embody the gap that has developed between the civilian world and the military world. I knew nothing when my husband entered the military, and like I said, I was kind of suspicious of it. And now, 8 years later, I just have a much better sense of who's in the military, what I have in common with them just as a human being, the same concerns, and in a better sense, too, of the role of the military and our responsibility as civilians for what's done with that military and what kind of a military we want. I think working on this book has really brought all that home to me, and my goal with this book was to enable civilians to walk a mile in the shoes of these families and, you know, and maybe think more deeply about their own relationship with the military and how they can reach out and engage with it, because if we turn our backs on the military, we get the military we deserve.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Kristen, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Kristen Henderson has been our guest in this portion of the program. She is the author most recently of While They're at War, The True Story of American Families on the Home Front. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, the big action in the board trade taking place in the bean pit for the day. They were down 13 3/4 in the nearby Novembers. Today we're off 9 cents. And the wheat pit futures were a little bit higher, both in Chicago and Kansas City. The March wheat today had a settlement price at 440. They were up 4 3/4 in Kansas City. Their high at 447, the low there at 438 for the day. Once again, that March contract in Kansas City up 4 3/4 today. May wheat for the hard red winter wheat at 450.5 on the high, the low at 442. Settlement price at $4.46. They were up 6.5 cents for the day. Now the soft red winter wheat from the Chicago Board of Trade March contract finished the day like this: 377 the high, the low at 368. Settlement price at 372.5. They were up 4.5 for the day. The main futures at 388 high, low at $3.79. Settlement price at $3.84 a bushel, up 4.5 for the May wheat. July contract, your harvest month, 397.5 the high, the low at $3.89. Settlement price at 393.25. They were up 3.5 cents. And September futures are 408 high, low at 398. Settlement price at 403.5, and they were up 4 for the day. December contract, settlement price 4.25 higher at 414 for the wheat, with a high of 18 and a low at 10 even. March wheat for next year, 423, the high, the low at 17. Settlement price at $4.22. They were up 3 3/4. From the corn pit, March contract down, 226.5 the high, low at 224.5, settlement price at $2.26. They were down a half on the day. The May futures, 237.25 the high, low at 35, settlement price at 37, down a quarter of a cent. And July futures, 246.25 the high, the low at 44.5, settlement price at $2.46. They were down a quarter. September contract down a quarter of a cent today as well, 252.5 the high, the low at 51, settlement price at $2.52. They were down 1/4. Now your December contract for new crop corn, 262 the high, low at $2.60. Settlement price unchanged today, 261.75. March contract, 267.75 the high, the low at 66.25. Settlement price at $2.67.5. They were up 1/4, and the May futures were unchanged today at 270. March oats, 190 the high, the low at 86. Settlement price at 87. They were off a nickel. The May futures were down 1¢ at $1.90.25. Soy complex now. March beans, a 598 high, low at 582. Settlement price 587.5, down 13 3/4. There were rainfall in Argentina, and it looks like Brazil may get some as well. May futures 611 the high, the low at 595. Settlement price at 601, down 13.5 for the day. And July futures 13 3/4. This settlement price lower at 610.25. 621 the high, the low at 04.5. Once again, that July bean contract, $6.10, down 13 3/4 for the day. August soybeans off 12 cents, 622 the high, the low at 609. Settlement price at 613. In September futures, 620 the high, low at 11.5. Settlement price at $6.13. They were off 11.5 for the day. And the November beans down 9 cents, 628 the high, the low at 15.5. A settlement price for the Noves, $6.20.5. They were off 9 for the day. January futures off 9 as well, 630.5 the high, the low at 21. Settlement price at $6.25 3/4 for the January soybeans. They were down 9 for the day. March bean meal, 183.40 the high, low at 178.50. Settlement price at 180.20, off 5.10. And the May futures down $5 even, 185.40 the high, the low at 180.60. Settlement price at 182.20. Bean oil down 28 cents today, 23.23 the high, the low at 22.85 for the March, and a settlement price at 23.05 off 28. and the May futures were down 22. 23.62 the high, the low at 23.25. Settlement price there at 23.49 for the day, and that May bean oil contract finished the day 22 lower. In just a few minutes during the closing market report, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. That happens at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon. By the way, we have a new web address for the website for WILL Ag. In fact, it's fairly easy, WILLAG.org. That's WILLAG.org, and you can get to our homepage. You can see all the podcasts and daily programming, the latest numbers from USDA, and all the upcoming events, including our March 7th All-Day Ag Outlook. I'm Todd Gleason, the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, in just a moment.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
Livestock prices finished higher today. March feeder cattle, the high 107.85, the low 107.15, the settlement 107.62.5, that up 30. April 108.15, the high 107.40, the low 107.85, the settlement that up 20. May feeders 108.80, the high 108.20, the low, the settlement 108.50, that down 2.5. February live cattle 90.60, the high 89.95, the low, the settlement 90.55, that up 60. April 88.50, the high 87.85, the low 88.47.5, the settlement that up 77.5. April lean hog 63.75 was the high today for April lean hog, 63.75, the low 62.85, finishing at 63.25, that up 7.5. May 68.50, the high 67.75, the low 68.32.5, the settlement that up 12.5. June lean hog 71 even, the high 70.10, the low, the settlement 70.72.5, that up 7.5. July lean hog 68.80, the high 67.95, the low, finishing at 68.32.5, that down 15. And February pork bellies, the high today 86.10, the low 84 even, the settlement 86.05. That was up 295. The Dow is off 48 points at 11,067. The NASDAQ is off 23 points at 2260. The S&P 500 off 5 at 1282.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming on AM 580 as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, on the AM radio dial at 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft. The producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Coming up tomorrow in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will welcome to the program Pulitzer Prize winning history.